Thank you very much, and thanks very much for the introduction of my team. I know it's a large team, but I suspect that you're going to be seeing a lot more of them in the coming months, particularly if a proposed amendment to the legislation comes to the committee. You'll also see, Chair, that a number of your members will be aware that we've transformed some of the roles and identities from our previous lives in National Treasury. So you'll be aware of some of us having played various roles in the past. We're now sitting here in the guise of the Financial Intelligence Center. Chair, I have a presentation here which will give an overview of the sort of background to the legislation and the system that we are trying to introduce and build in the country. And that has reference to the international context as well. We then look at the Financial Intelligence Center itself, its various responsibilities, its functions, and the work we're doing. We give an update of our work in the past year, and then identify some of the challenges that are before us in the coming period. Chair, I shall run through the presentation. It's relatively high level, and certain members will have seen some aspects of it probably when last we were here, probably 2 years ago in our chair. And then we're open to questions and can deal with questions thereafter. So I'll start running through that now. The key elements in South Africa's anti-money laundering and combating the financing terrorism system, that AML-CFT phrase will come up again and again, and it's part of the international lexicon in this world that we're working with on money laundering, terror financing, AML-CFT. The system comprises six elements, and these elements are built into the international standard, and all countries are expected to address these issues and implement and work around them. The first one is the criminalization of money laundering and financing of terrorism. That is done in this country through three pieces of legislation: the Prevention of Organized Crime Act, the FIC Act, and the Protection of Constitutional Democracy Against Terrorist Activities and the Pocketara. Then there's the administrative component, which are all the obligations on businesses, and a range of businesses, particularly those in the financial sector, but then also the non-financial sector, such as lawyers, accountants, estate agents, and so on. And it poses a series of obligations on those businesses to know, identify, and understand their customers, and to report to the centre and so on. We'll deal with those in a bit more detail going forward. The third element comprises the ability for law enforcement to investigate and prosecute on the basis of those pieces of legislation. The requirement that there be a supervisory component monitoring the compliance of these pieces of legislation. The Financial Intelligence Center, the fact that a single national capacity exists to receive and to process information coming in, feed that through to law enforcement, and then the element of international cooperation, that there's the ability of South Africa to share information with other countries, and obviously there's a series of protocols in place to ensure that that's done with integrity and properness. So those six elements find expression in the system through the legislation and through the functioning that has been established. And that's the background check to much of what we're going to be talking about today. Moving on then, this committee passed the Financial Intelligence Center Act number 38 right towards the end of 2001. And what it does is it helps create the anti-money laundering environment in South Africa. And the main intentions there are to ensure the integrity of the financial sector, but particularly the second bullet, to identify the proceeds or help to identify the proceeds of unlawful activities and thereby combat money laundering activities. A And then in brackets, chair, importantly, since May 2005, to also assist in combating of terrorist financing, the financing of terrorism. And in part of the way the legislation has been phrased and the result of very intensive discussions in the Congress some years ago, to assist in building a partnership between the private and public sectors in relation to anti-money laundering and terror financing, the combating of these. As I said earlier, the FIT Act complements the Prevention of Organized Crime Act of 1998, where the actual offense of money laundering is set up, and it also is impacted on by the POCA-TARA, which came into effect in May 2005. So those three pieces of legislation act as a troika, reinforcing one another and creating the obligations and capacities that go into an informed system as a whole. When we talk about imposing know your customer and other obligations on the wide range of the comfort institution, at this point in time there are 19 categories of so-called accountable institutions that have to report to the FIT or implement these obligations. They include client identification and verification, record keeping, reporting various forms of transactions and sharing that information with the Financial Intelligence Center, and then other measures to promote compliance, including the training of staff. That's an obligation that is placed on business. What the Act also does is impose obligations on various supervisory bodies, and we can talk about that in a bit more detail, and then gives law enforcement authorities the responsibilities to enable them to conduct investigations and prosecutions. And then the Act also creates the Financial Intelligence Center, those that are sitting here this morning. The next slide, difficult to read possibly, but it gives one a sense of the history of this. This is not something which is, didn't come suddenly, didn't come to the committee in 2001 out of the blue, so to speak. There's been a long history of interaction, discussion, which goes back some 15 years. And in many respects, Chair, for Africa is playing a bit of a catch-up game here, that we are implementing anti-money laundering systems in the country, which other countries had initiated in the late 80s and early 90s. And with our reintegration into the global economy and into international standards, we were forced, in inverted commas, or obliged to very rapidly, towards the end of the 90s and early 2000s, to play that catch-up game to ensure that particularly our banking sector, but the other financial institutions, as well as law enforcement, were on a par with their counterparts internationally, and thereby able to conduct business in a way which met the international standard as it was set then. That standard has subsequently evolved, and subsequent to the passing of this legislation, there has been evolution which impacts on what we're trying to do, and will impact on the legislation and our way of operating. The major force there was the 9/11 attacks in the US, and therefore the introduction of the notion of combating the financing of terrorism, and that had a series of impacts, and then the actual standard itself set by the Financial Action Task Force, and I'll deal with that in some detail, and the methodology to assess whether countries are implementing those standards also changed in 2003-2004, and we have an obligation to meet those changes of those standards. And that has a series of ramifications for which we are grappling with at the moment. The next slide, again, is illustrative and gives a sense of the relationship between the various pieces of legislation and as they move from the financial sector all the way to law enforcement, and the various structures that operate within this landscape. We're talking about not simply the FIT. The FIT, in a sense, is a pivot, but we're talking about business on the one hand, the secular banks, insurers and so on, but also various financial intermediaries, then going through to the non-financial, such as, as I said, accountants, lawyers, estate agents, casinos, all being brought into the loop. The supervisory bodies that oversee those particular components of the economy or sectors, coming through then to national treasury, which has responsibility for oversight of many of these areas, and then through to the law enforcement components, the African Police Services, the National Prosecuting Authority with audit, various components, the South African Revenue Service, the intelligence agency, and the FIC sits somewhere in the middle, playing a regulatory role, playing a responsible for policy, as well as doing a providing essentially an intelligence, in inverted commas, but the smaller and not one of the agencies, an intelligence relationship by feeding information through for law enforcement to act upon. Now, taking a step back from all of that, from the South African system, and putting it into some kind of context check, we need to understand that all of this AML-CSP system, anti-money terror financing system, has a context. The first element of that, as is in the top block here on the slide, deals with three United Nations conventions in particular, the Vienna Convention, the Palermo Convention, and the Terror Financing, and then a set of Security Council resolutions. And those conventions deal with organized crime, with drug trafficking, and with terror financing, and then the Security Council on a continuous basis, the application thereof. And those conventions for which Africa has signed up means we, as a country, as a member state, we've become obliged to implement and see through in various forms. Then the actual AML-CSP standards are set by the Financial Action Task Force, which is a body comprised of 33 different member countries. So Africa was invited to become a member in 2003, in June 2003. And that body, the FATF, sets the international standards, and it's expressed in a formulation called the 40 R's, the 40 plus 9, 40 recommendations dealing with money laundering and the 9 official recommendations dealing with the financing of terrorism. And the good thing is to get expression in legal and operational sense to the 40 plus 9. And all the way through our presentation, we're going to refer to AML-CSP and we're going to refer to 40 plus 9 as the benchmark, the standard from which everything else cascades. The FAT itself is a central body of, as I said, the 33 members. It then has affiliated to 9 regional bodies. In our instance, we have the Eastern and Southern African Anti-Money Laundering Group, which comprises 14 countries, in other words, not an exact match with Sarah, but 14 countries in the region. And that is echoed in South America, in the Caribbean, East Asia, European Asia, and in the Asia Pacific area, and in Europe as well. So we have these 7 regional bodies all linked to the FATF. The FATF then also works very closely and increasingly closely with the United Nations, with the Security Council resolutions, with the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank, and the Commonwealth Secretariat in particular. In relation to the IMF and the World Bank, there's now an agreement that's been reached that when the IMF and the World Bank do the customary ESTAT, the anti-money laundering terror financing components are built into that, and the assessment is done according to the FATF standards, and so that there's an alignment and commonality between the two, effectively a seamlessness, so that you get an assessment either by the FATF of a country's anti-money laundering standards, or by the fund or the bank, and all of the reports are then shared equally. And we can deal with that in a bit more detail later on. In the South African context, cascading down from the FATF level, you have the Financial Intelligence Center, which has been charged with trying to bring all of these elements together in one form or another and to oversee that, although not necessarily the practical expression of the different components, obviously. And that then requires the involvement of a range of different government departments, National Treasury in particular, but also safety and security, police, justice, and then again, so far as the United Nations involved, for example, foreign affairs, and other departments as well. So it's a range of different government departments with a range of different responsibilities, some from a regulatory policy perspective, others from a purely operational one, capital enforcement, for example. And we then cascade down to the lowest level. We then talk about anti-money laundering, terror financing operations. We have a very particular mandate in relation to that, which is to receive reports from the accountable institutions in business, to analyze and to feed the information through in the form of referrals to law enforcement and intelligence and revenue service to act upon, investigate, and to bring to prosecution in some form. We're also given the responsibility for overseeing the supervisory or the compliance monitoring aspect of the supervisory bodies. So that's the system, description of the system overall and the context within which we're trying to implement and roll out the FIC Act, but also roll it out in relation to poker, roll it out in relation to pocket power. These three things work together and they've been implemented in that context. The Financial Action Task Force, I don't want to deal in too much detail. I think it's something we can touch on in question form. Except the key area here that I wanted to touch on, sorry, I've gone one slide too far, is that of mutual evaluation. The Financial Action Task Force conducts the equivalent of a peer review on all its members in the form of what's called a mutual evaluation. South Africa is expected to be evaluated sometime in 2008, sometime next year, probably mid-2008, where the system as a whole will be looked into by a committee of experts from FATF member countries. And that committee will then come in and evaluate and prepare a report. That report is very important in the sense that it guides a member country on where deficiencies have been identified, sets out potential remedial actions that need to follow, and the report is then made available publicly. It gets put on the FATF website, including the IMF and the World Bank. And one of the consequences, one of the synopsis, then gets used by the credit rating agencies, for example, to look at risk in a country. And then that can impact either positively or negatively on the risk rating a country has. So if a member country has performed particularly badly, it obviously raises risk and poses serious questions. So we certainly don't want to be put into that category, and I don't believe we will be as a country. But we must also understand that these systems are exceedingly difficult. The thresholds are exceedingly high, very, very high, and exceedingly difficult to implement because of the cross-cutting, transversal nature that they have, the involvement of, in a sense, entire government as well as the private sector. And when we look at a number of our colleagues within the FATF who have gone through recent mutual evaluations under the recent methodology, everybody has suffered. The systems, even if they've been in place for 8, 12, 15 years, all have deficiencies. So clearly what we have to do is we have to understand the core elements of a system, we need to make sure those are in place, and then what are the nice to haves, and we must work towards those over the next 5 or 8 years or so. And roll this process off. If we come back to the centre here and the core of critical institutional stakeholders, as the FIC, I'm now talking about the centre, obviously Parliament and reporting to Parliament, we report on a day-to-day basis to the Minister of Finance, has oversight of the entire system. We have the accountable institutions reporting to us in the form of making reports. We then also work closely with the supervisory bodies who have to ensure the compliance components, and then we relate very closely to law enforcement, revenue, intelligence, and prosecution. So these, it's not quite a Venn diagram, but I put aside to get there. These are the different stakeholders with whom we relate and who in one way or another have obligations under these three core pieces of legislation. The cycle, the reporting cycle, or the set of obligations can be described in a slightly different way, and to illustrate this using the slide, the first element, number one there, is that business accounts for institutions have to implement various compliance measures. As I said, Know Your Customer would be one of those, for example. Then there is a compliance monitoring component, which we would request or require of the supervisory bodies. There's their reporting to the FIC. There's analysis by the FIC, point number four. That then refers to the law enforcement authorities. They then, point number six, do the investigation, prosecution. And then out of this, there's also trend analysis, which we are obliged to do, but we can only do that in relation to the input we get from our partners. As a result of the investigations, as a result of the prosecution, to help us identify and understand where and what are new forms of money laundering. That needs to be fed back to the reporting institutions, the business, the work. They can keep their eyes open for these new forms. That then feeds into policy development, so we can therefore adjust the legal and regulatory framework, which then leads into the legislation development for which we have responsibility, and as a reason of which you will be seeing some of these people more often than you would wish to in the next few months. So that, in a sense, is the value chain, the totality of the system as expressed in the international standard, the system that we are trying to implement in the country. The slide that we use to illustrate all of this particular one, to show how the system works. The FIC sits at the center, the cylinder, the green cylinder at the center. On the left-hand side, you'll have the accountable institutions reporting into the FIC, but also carrying out the compliance measures. They are overseen by the supervisory bodies on the extreme left. We then report through to the investigative authorities, the column on the right here. All of that is done in relation to the international standard, the bar across the top, the 40+9. And we try and create a loop between all of these things. The component that I haven't touched on sufficiently, perhaps, is the sharing of information. In terms of our legislation, but again in terms of international standards, there's an obligation on the Financial Intelligence Center to be able to share information with our equivalent structures in other countries. Information which is protected, obviously. There's very few protocols in place for what gets moved and how it can be used, and certain caveats placed on what can be done with that information. We belong to an organization of a financial intelligence unit. We're the Financial Intelligence Center, classified as a financial intelligence unit. There are hundreds countries with such units who belong to this international organization, and that then creates a global network through which financial intelligence is able to be passed, and through which we're then able to work together to monitor the movement of transactions and feed it into our work and into the work of law enforcement for investigation. So what's been happening globally is that there's a massive capacity to be able to track the movement of funds between jurisdictions. As I say, there are very special protocols in place, and if you wish, we can deal with some of those later on. So that is the overall architecture, and it explains and shows where we sit in relation to the system overall. Now, turning to the accountable institutions and obligations they have in terms of the FIC Act, these institutions are those classified as most vulnerable to money laundering, 19 different categories: banks, insurance industry, brokers, casinos, accountants, those state agents. And Chair, I'm raising a flag here. Based on our experience, we might want to introduce a couple more categories as we go forward as a consequence of what we're seeing taking place out there. But that's for a future discussion. The obligations on those accountable institutions, at this point in time, they're required to submit suspicious transaction reports, STR, to the FIC. And we'll deal with the details of that later on. In the legislation, provision is also made but has not yet been promulgated for cash reports to be made to the FIC and electronic funding across border funds. We will only promulgate or request promulgation of those sections once our IT capacity has been built to be able to receive these. When we start talking about cash reporting and ESGs, generally we're talking about a huge number of reports on a continuous basis coming through. So we're in the process of designing an IT system that can accommodate all of that and go through the necessary testing to ensure that we then get a seamless process of reporting taking place before we promulgate the legislation, before it kicks into effect. So the SDRs are the only reporting obligations at this point in time, although the PASAR also places the reporting of financing property to the FIC. The accountable institutions have an obligation to keep records for 5 years in relation to those in relation to their plans and all components in terms of legislation. Those plans need to be identified and those identities need to be verified. They need to appoint a compliance officer responsible for AML, CSP and the training of staff on a continuous basis. The future reporting obligations I've alluded to and accountable institutions in the future, for example, dealers in various forms of minerals would be one of those areas we want to flag for the future. So that's the accountable institutions. The supervisory body includes the Financial Services Board, the Science and Reserve Bank, particularly in the form of the Banking Supervision Department or the Registrar Bank, the CIPRO, Companies Intellectual Property Registration Organization, the State Agency Affairs Board, dealing with the State Agents and Property Development, the Independent Regulatory Board of Auditors, the OLPAR, the National Gambling Board, the SJC Securities and South African Law Society. They're obliged to monitor within their particular sector the extent to which accountable institutions do in fact comply. Now, the approach we've taken as part of the rollout of the FIC Act is that we can't do all of this in a single go. So what we've done is we've taken a phased approach and said we start off with the credentials with the bank and the financial sector, moving into some insurance and associated, and now increasingly we're working with the state agents and gambling and so on. So beginning to unfold the blanket until we encompass all of those who have obligations both to report and account, as well as the supervisory body. Chair, I'm very pleased that I read today that the banking supervisor will be delivering his report next week, and I think that in particular, a lot of good work has been done by the banks in relation to their compliance obligations. And they've certainly set a standard and approach which is being replicated across the board. And I hope that the registrar will be able to talk in a bit more detail about that. Certainly, he's done a lot of good work and the banks themselves have done good work. So there's an opportunity for further discussion on that component here. I want to flag as well in the next section here, statutory versus self-regulatory versus non-supervised bodies. The list of supervisory bodies in Schedule 2 of the Act are those that have a statutory obligation to supervise or self-regulate. But we're also seeing, for example, non-supervised sectors that have an obligation to report. For example, motorcycle use. There's no supervisory body responsible for motor car dealers. So what are we going to do about that? And certainly our thinking thus far, and this will be a part of the amendment we would like, or Treasury would like to propose to you later in the year, is that the FIC steps into that breach, certainly an interim until some kind of supervisory arrangement can be made. But we feel it's incumbent that there is a supervision of compliance, and we then be given the power to be able to do that. At this point in time, there's nothing like that. And then the point in relation to that is that supervision cannot simply exist at a national level, working with a national entity. The monitoring of compliance has to take place where business operates, conducts business, and therefore it's got to be based on a regional and more local level as well. And certainly, there are various discussions taking place, and allocation of resources and so on, to be able to conduct compliance monitoring, certainly by the FIC, on a localized basis. The approach that we've taken is to work closely with the various supervisory bodies and to get involved in joint audits, joint inspections. These have been conducted, for example, with the banking supervisor, with the FSB, I've sent you a brief on that one, the state agents, and the National Gambling Board. And that feeds both ways. On the one hand, the FIC has been understanding that the supervisory body itself is understanding of its role, and we're learning in the process. So it creates a closed loop that we're all developing capacity and understanding of how the system itself works. And obviously picking up very valuable information from an operational as well as from a policy and regulatory perspective. And again, we can talk about some of the details of that further down this presentation. So this slide is just to give you a sense, again, of the complexity of the system. We have different ministers. I'm sure the governor of the Reserve Bank would appreciate being called a minister. But at a high level, we have the head of the Reserve Bank, we have finance, trade, industry, justice. All have supervisory obligations or overseeing supervisory and regulatory components. Various supervisors include banking supervision, financial services, boards, JIT, going all the way through to the IRBA. And then the various sectors. And all of these have got to be brought together, and they've all got to be implementing the various obligations and so on. And at this point in time, we're sitting with having to struggle and make sure that there is a mix of all of these. So it's a huge task. It's a task which is going to take many, many years to unfold and to have the correct sense of traction and success. On the referral side, so we have compliance, we have the coming to the FIC, it's referred straight to law enforcement authorities. They have a responsibility of investigating and prosecuting. They receive the referral from the FIC. They can make requests to the FIC for further information. They can assist the FIC by providing us with targets and focus on where to look and where they need us to look. And all of this is channeled through appointed authorized officers. And that's they designate an individual to be designated by a commissioner or the DG's responsible for those particular departments. And it's through them that information then passes between the FIC and the respective law enforcement authority. And that's to protect the integrity of the information. Made very clear some years ago in the part of the legislation that in order to construct the relationship between the bank, for example, and law enforcement, you need to know that the confidentiality of the information the bank has doesn't get compromised in any way. And so that as it comes through into the system, through the FIC and out the other side, that integrity is maintained all the way through. And the law enforcement authority is then utilizing information for a very specific investigation and not allowing it to be distributed wantonly on the other side. They then also provide the FIC with further access to government information. We don't have direct access, but we can work through the law enforcement authority to enable us then to verify and to check information that might be sitting on our system and allow further value add to analysis process as well as investigation. Part of our responsibility is to ensure regular feedback on progress that's been made, so we can then both adjust our system, but also the regulatory component, and then feedback to the accountable institutions, so they know what they should be looking for, and they also understand better the quality or the lack of quality of the report that they're sending through to the FIC. So that loop of feedback becomes very, very important. So a final obligation, which sits with with us in the FIC, but depend very, very much on a close relationship with law enforcement is the collection, reporting, and statistics. How many reports have been received by the FIC? How many referrals have been made? How many investigations? How many successful prosecutions, for example? And that, at the moment, is a bit of a problem that we're working on. But we've got to start getting reliable stats coming through to enable them, us to get a proper view of the entire system operating. This is an illustration of the feedback loop that I was talking to you about. The FIC sits in the middle of a relationship. The top loop goes to the FIC, goes through to law enforcement, feedback comes in, and then out again as a quality reference to the accountable institutions. This is the ideal situation that we're trying to work towards. And certain of the reporting obligations are set out in statute, others are timelines that we try and negotiate and implement. But the sort of figure 8 figure on its side represents the ideal process of reporting and investigating and feeding back that we hope to achieve. The Financial Intelligence Center itself, various areas that I'd like to quickly touch on. The center is defined as a juristic person, located outside the public service, but within the public administration. And I think, again, if we go back a few years, a very intense debate in this chamber about the kind of people that the FIC would need to have, and an understanding then that we need to have a combination of dutiful public servants drawn from the public administration, but at the same time be open to and bring in people who were in business. There might well be different styles of work, different approaches, but also remuneration differences. And therefore, rather than being sitting within administration, having that flexibility and therefore created as a Section 3A entity under the PFMA to be able to work those pay scales if and when necessary. That's an issue which we're reviewing at this point in time to understand the benchmarking criteria and pay scales. Again, a further discussion. Accountable directly to the Minister of Finance, funded from the National Budget. Presently, we physically located in the National Treasury Building, but we are beginning to spread our wings somewhat and have to expand out of National Treasury. I think they would also prefer to get rid of us, quite honestly. So that's been an ongoing struggle. But I think while we're on that point, we are physically located there. Part of the initial implementation aspect was for Treasury to provide us with support and coverage in order to enable us to start functioning as an independent entity. Unfortunately, we messed up on some of the support, and we ended up having to account for our budget from day one, which wasn't ever planned. So we were playing a bit of catch up with Auditor General for the first couple of years. Similarly, until we understood more precisely the business processes involved, exactly the kinds of methodologies, we couldn't, for example, spend money on an IT system. So we would operate on the backbone of the Treasury IT system. Now that we've gone through all of those scoping processes, business analysis processes, the workload associated, etc., we are now able to start making that move away from Treasury to set up independent premises, physical processes, IT infrastructure, etc. And it does give Treasury some space to do its work. Our core responsibilities, to analyze information, as I've said, to refer that information to law enforcement. At this point in time, we have a mandate from the Minister to coordinate all the policy, and therefore to liaise both with the Treasury and other stakeholders, and private sector, and internationally, to monitor the work of the supervisory bodies that they are monitoring compliance, and very particularly to give guidance to accountable institutions and the supervisory bodies in relation to the legislation. Now, that guidance is also an issue. We do not pretend to understand the business of any of the particular industries, but we have to be able to interpret that work in relation to the legislation. And therefore, it's not just a question of legislation and regulation, but also a set of guidelines to guide the practice within that particular sector. We are presently monitoring and inspecting for compliance with no supervisory bodies, and I mentioned, for example, motor car users, but what about certain paraplegics who are obliged to report, might have, for example, a fundable asset management component, and therefore there's an accountable, in terms of the legislation, accountability issue. What about the first bank? So we step into the breach of the supervisor and taking on that role. We exchange information between the bodies of the country, so and with other such we participate liaise with the Financial Action Task Force, which sets the standards, and we work very closely, and Hilary for next to me is responsible for the relationship with the Eastern South African Anti-Money Laundering Group, working with other countries in the region, both as a group as a whole, but also providing technical assistance to particular countries. For example, she's just returned from the state in Mozambique, working with the Ministry of Finance in finalizing their legislation and developing implementation plans for the rollout of the legislation and the creation of a financial intelligence unit in Maputo. So it's providing that kind of technical assistance on an ongoing basis. Finally, we administer the Financial Intelligence Center Act. That act, as I said earlier on, comprises the act itself, but also the regulations, the exemptions, and the guidance notes that flow thereafter. Moving on, share the structure, starting components. This slide sets out in a very high level of the structure, divided into three major silos supported by corporate services or administration support services. The one silo, and I hesitate to use that word because we've got to prevent this audience, as far as possible, slipping into a silo approach to doing our work, is the one of compliance and prevention, which works and deals with the business world and the supervisory body world out there to ensure the monitoring compliance. The monitoring and analysis component, which deals with the crunching of all the information and referring it to law enforcement, the relationship with the law enforcement authority, and then the legal and policy side, which is all the administration of the act, policy development, and the interpretation of the international standard liaison of the international bodies. And then the administration supports all the HR side, financial, IT, and so on and so forth. So that's a high-level perspective of the organization. Moving to our annual report, you'll get a copy of that chair in the next couple of weeks. The final draft has been prepared, waiting for final from the Auditor General. From the legislation and policy side here, a lot of work has been done on amending the legislation, and I'd like Advocate Smith to pick up on that later on. But in essence, the first round of amendments to the legislation will be to give the supervisory body more teeth in the ability to act upon any compliance failures. And then also sets up the FIC's obligation in relation to compliance a bit more clearly than is presently in the book or in the act. May I also say that this particular matter was highlighted in the FATF Mutual Evaluation of South Africa, which it conducted prior to South Africa becoming a member of the FATF in 2003. They highlighted the fact that there were these deficiencies in our act, and it's certainly one of the things that we need to correct. This takes place in the context of a longer-term review of our legislation. And there are two processes taking place. There's an amendment which you will hopefully see from Treasury later this year. We're also conducting a longer-term review which looks at our legislation, looks at the revised international standards. It looks at our practice over the past 3 or 4 years, and also looked at the results of the mutual evaluation that was conducted in 2003, and we will seek to correct deficiencies that have been identified, and we will seek to be proactive and identify where we're moving over the next 5 to 8 years and incorporate that into the amended legislation as well. But that will be coming sometime in the more distant future. As part of the legislation policy
component of FIC, we're also
involved. And Mario Monegas to Mascaragay, feeling the startup from your engagement with us on your annual report. Because I think you must be careful that you not too much information on your annual report. I have a sense that you seem to anticipate that you may not be engaged in much of your annual report.
I'm very grateful for that guidance, but I think that there's an insinuation that you're going to call me back here in a couple of weeks' time. Okay, that point very well taken. We are preparing for the mutual evaluation, which will be coming in 2008. This is not just the FIC, but the system as a whole. Ongoing participation in FATF, ongoing participation in the East and Southern African Anti-Money Laundering Group, which I've set up. On the reporting side, we can report that 21,000 employment transaction reports were made in the last financial year. The majority of these were received from the financial side of things, but only 12% of those reports were received from non-financial, in other words, casinos, state agencies, and so on. That's an issue that we will be dealing with and trying to up reporting on that side. And that's done through a combination of compliance monitoring, engagement, awareness with institutions, and so on. We then made 549 referrals to investigating authorities, and on the basis of our records, to the value of excess of 1.4 billion rand that's gone through for further investigation. The difficulty in terms of our legislation, the FICA Act, and so on, is that my ability to report on any of the investigating components thereof. So there's a bit of a limitation discussing that in too much detail. The following couple of slides simply illustrate the gradual growth of the reporting for the 4 years that we have now been receiving reports. We have a total of 65,487 in the final column, and you will see then there's been a gradual increase year on year in relation to those. And then the split between financial and non-financial. On the compliance prevention side, and again, this is relatively new. Once we've got the reporting scheme happening, we're starting to push harder and harder on the compliance monitoring side. Ongoing monitoring, providing the guidance notes in relation to suspicious transaction and terror financing, working closely with the gambling board and in the form of exchange control departments, as well as banking supervisor, state agency affairs board. In all of this, conducting a series of on-site visits, audits, inspections of those particular sectors, and with consequent follow-up. Working closely with FSB, increasingly closely, public awareness and training, and then ongoing various interactions. Chair, one of the things we refer here to interns, we realized, and unexpectedly, we thought that we would create a market for financial analysts. We've actually created a market, it seems, for compliance officers. And it's very clear to us that this working in FIC for a very short period of time provides a good stepping stone to becoming a junior, if not a senior compliance officer in business. So we're now getting our heads around this and starting to try and bring in people and put them on various kind of internal training, internships, and try and create rapid capacity enhancement so that both we can both keep, but at the same time accepting that we're going to lose people. But losing people and understanding that actually contributes to the overall pool of people who understand the totality of what's required here. Quite honestly, we need good people in business so that we can ensure there is further compliance there. We need a relationship. So in a sense, there's not a lot, but it does mean that there's an allocation of funds that we didn't anticipate, and we need to manage the process very carefully. The final point here relates to the amendment bill, the imposition of an administrative penalty regime, which we'll discuss. Then on the financials matter, if you want to go into the same detail, safe to say that the Auditor General signed off on our finances a few days ago, gave the FIC a clean audit, and I want to compliment our CFO for the fine work there. No matters of emphasis, no qualifications, and certainly having started off from a zero base, and I was just saying to Member Woods the difficulty he will recall that implementing or passing CFMA through this committee some years ago, the difficulty of meeting CFMA requirements from that zero base, it's actually an enormous task, but fortunately we've succeeded, and I need to congratulate our CFO in relation to that. Part of our history here, you'll see in the financials, is that we were allocated a total of $73 million for the first 3 years of establishment and functioning of the FIC. But that $73 million related to a non-existent entity, which only took 2 to 3 years to begin to start functioning. Quite why that happened, I can't account for that. I wasn't around at the time. But the discussion with Treasury was that those surpluses were then held over until the FIC took up that stuff and started implementing. So there's this sort of history which we're dealing with, eradicating those surpluses. There's a slight surplus remains this year of 7,043,000, which roll over into next year. There's an amount of $42 million set aside from Treasury for next year, plus another sum of $40 million which should have been allocated this year.
Which is like just more with the Treasury on one point.
That's a point to illustrate the point you made earlier on, that is maybe we are privileged so enough that it would move into the annual report.
Yeah, I appreciate that. But now that I have allowed it to get my favor, time I'm going to give you the annual report.
There's nobody here with a pretty
face.
It's worth your while not to
bring
a
friend. Yeah, so I guess. But what I was trying to warn you is not to steal the standard program. Be a bit economical with this detail so that.
Do you want me to move on?
Yeah.
I won't deal with the next phase, but that's purely the IT spend and IT development stuff, and we're really incorporating previous for that. Next step, the big challenges are facing us. As I've indicated, the amendments to the legislation coming through later this year from Treasury, the overall review, the mutual evaluation preparation for next year, ongoing international cooperation, and the technical assistance. That's on the legal policy side. The analysis side, to continue receiving reports, streamlining the processes and so on. The infrastructure to enable that. Developing a memorandum of understanding and relationships with our various stakeholders. And then, and very critically, the building of capacity on the law enforcement side, the financial investigation, and the ability of prosecutors to carry through their obligations in terms of various pieces of legislation. On the compliance side, again, ongoing issuing guidance notes, working with compliance, working with business, working with supervisory bodies. I think in there you'll see, again, part of the international component, the need to understand a risk-based approach to anti-money laundering, the implications thereof on all sides of this equation, what that means. We've got to work that one through. We've started the process, we're working with international bodies, we're working with Financial Services Authority in the UK to assist us. They've successfully developed an approach. We need to learn from that and find out how we're going to, in the forthcoming 3-year cycle, implement all of that. Chair, as part of the amendments that are coming your way, we'll also need to create a dedicated inspection capacity to be able to do the compliance monitoring of those sectors which do not have a supervisory component, ongoing public awareness and training, and then also the threat analysis. Where are the threat money laundering threats that we face in the system overall, and then how do we respond? Can we be proactive? Can we stay a step or two ahead? On the international side, as I mentioned, continue our relations and to strengthen. Just on the growing the Financial Intelligence Centres organisation, chair, we're going to be spreading across two buildings, both in National Treasury and outside, in order to grow, but also to conquer in our basic environment. All of that then provides a testing ground to be able to stand independently, particularly from an IT perspective. We have an agreement that we move into our own customized building 2.5 years from now, which will accommodate most of our functions, if not all. Part of our discussion, again, relates to how do we bridge the gap between national and local. We need to have a local presence in order to both assist investigations, but also to monitor compliance. So, yes, there's a head office component, but we also need to create more and more of a regional presence in order to be able to carry out those functions. And again, we spoke of all of that, and we'll build that into our MTEP presentations later this month. On the IT side, massive scoping exercise has been conducted over the last 18 months. We're very confident we've got the right design. We've checked that design against our counterparts, particularly in Australia and Canada. We've modelled a lot on their legislation and so on. We believe that at the end of this process, we'll have an IT system which is up there with the very, very best in the world. We need to make sure that we've stress tested it. We don't have problems when we switch, put the switch on. We won't switch on. We'll put on a series of small switches until we get on the big one. And obviously, it has to be up to seriously secure standards to protect the integrity of all that information that's being crunched and so on. So that's the process which is continue to be unfolding, and we'll start the building process towards the latter part of the financial year in the next 18 months. Internal systems, again, it's all around ethics issues, values, security, and making sure that we minimize any threat from not having sufficient procedures, practices, and so on in place, and to be able to deal with the security issues. Values and ethics become a critical component thereof. We need to aim towards a staff of 135 by the end of this financial year. Now that's the first plateau. In our longer term thinking and planning, we're looking at 350 to 400 people. That's employed on the books of the FIC. That, we believe, will give us the full ability to perform against our mandate. At the same time, we outsource numerous functions, for example, around the building of the IT or scoping side of the IT. That would be one example. But a lot of the tenuous work on operating procedures and policy development and so on as well. We don't have the wherewithal at this point in time to do that. We have to get outside of the infrastructure. Also need to, on a continuous basis, increase the number of secondees, particularly from law enforcement and intelligence side, sitting inside the FIC. It gives us, builds up the expertise on the inside of the FIC, it builds up knowledge and understanding on their side, and it enables the more seamless movement of information back and forth between the different agencies and ourselves. Chair, I've come to an end. Thank you very much. I hope I haven't gone into too much detail for you, but I hope provided enough of a background for further discussion. And as I said at the beginning, we're here to hear your questions and save me the disgrace of not being able to provide you with answers. I've got my letters next to me. Thank you very much.
Okay, thanks very much, Mr. Chair. I'm just going to let you know that before I come to the past 2 years, I actually kind of point you for the situation for you.
Thank you, Chairperson. This is really small issues. The committee's agenda does say that the presentation would cover implementation as well, which you did touch on, but I do appreciate the comprehensive background you've given us. It certainly helps remind us of the actual order of that. But back to the issue of implementation and some of the lessons you might have heard, I'm aware of the odd newspaper article, the odd grant coming from banks. I'm certain issues which I want to know what your view is on those issues, whether you intend to do anything about them. In fact, one of the most recently taken article I picked up online yesterday from the National Guardian, which was, the heading was, Fika Juden. Yeah, and it concerns a couple of issues. Firstly, it starts to suggest that maybe Fika, in many respects, has become a major pain in the butt for law-abiding citizens, but a minor urgent to seizing criminal officers. And it bases it largely on certain, what they call, onerous registration requirements of the Act, which went way beyond other countries such as America and the UK. Well, just for the banks alone, we took an undertaking of having to secure additional and register additional information on 17 million clients. The cost to the industry that they involved was estimated at 750 million. I'm just one of them that was very inconvenienced by having to supply certain information which was very difficult to come by. So in view of what's happened in other countries and the irritation of share, is there and complaints that you've no doubt had, would there be any thought towards relaxing some of those requirements as it happened in other developed countries where it's more on a risk-based profile, not for the ordinary law-abiding guy who sat at the camp for many years and a regular job and a regular income. Also that an extension of this point is that should be such a deluge of paperwork that one wonders whether one's coping at all. And I look at your figures here, what was it, 21,500, it was a suspicious report. But what could be really suspicious about that figure is your conviction rate, which we're told is, if you can read, is very, very elaborate. Suspiciously that. Perhaps you could offer an explanation there. That could be the second point. And finally, earlier this week we met the Financial Services Board and we spoke about an academy of 16,000 odd people, financial service providers. And just checking to the FSB, one appreciates that these people have great influence in the financial markets. If they're not banks, they're not part of the insurance industry. A few of them are, but the majority are people who are making involvement for the business advice, placing money for people. The people who could be very much in the mainland, they can't have money laundering. How are they accommodated? I'm sure they are, but I mean, I just like you to point it out. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. I'd like to follow up on Dr. Wood's question by saying that one is of course aware that there's a huge international dimension to this FICA effort and legislation, not least our treaty obligations to the international community. And we're also aware of the possible value of preventing crime. And nobody could tell you how much crime has been prevented as a result of this. But when one considers how mightily you labour, I think put a little question mark behind the whole affair. I keep on getting complaints from members of the public, for example, about bank charges. And then the banks say that one of the things is that we're regulated to death and the cost of compliance are huge. And every financial institution and many, many big companies in South Africa have got these compliance officers that Mr. Mitchell referred to, all of whom are expensive. I said, and the banks then say, and all these institutions say, well, who's going to pay for this? The customer must pay, the consumer, the ordinary consumer. And that means the ordinary honest person, because 99% of people in South Africa are honest. They're the ones who are paying because of the potential crooks. That's really what it amounts to. I just think of my own experience. I'm poor because I'm a member of parliament. So, I've only a few properties, a few investments, a few pensions, a few bank accounts, and things like that. Yes, I would have had many if I'd say this is a successful attorney. But I just think of the number of times I had to comply, sometimes with the same financial institution, but with different accounts, your bond accounts, and then your current accounts, and so on. And the amount of paperwork and irritation that that caused me, and I can just imagine what caused them. Also to the extent where a dormant bond, a bond that had been paid off, no other dealings with that financial institution, they then write and tell you they have to comply and you've got to do this, that and the other. You contact them and you say, why do I have to comply? No, in case you want to re-advance on your bond in 10 years' time. I mean, that is the level to which the compliance goes. And perhaps there should be guidelines for these people, so it's not necessary to over-comply. And I then move on to just this question of the number of reports and the number of referrals. Now, with all this deluge of paper, with this compliance by millions of people in South Africa, the people have landed martyrs and brought forth 21,000 reports, of which 549 have been referred. And you can't or won't tell us how many successful prosecutions there have been. But I'd like to know how many prosecutions there have been of financial institutions and others who failed to comply. Because that's one category. And the other category is how many potential crooks have you prosecuted and how many have actually been convicted. Because that's the final output apart from the prevention aspect and the compliance of international treaties. Then I wonder whether any cost-benefit analysis has been done. Is the South African consumer getting value for money out of the FICA legislation which Parliament passed? Thank you, sir.
General question, once you find out, you know, if there is a mission to take a seller, as South Africa, we are playing a sharp role in this sector or in this issue. Take into consideration that we envisage that by the 2014, we have a monetary currency in South. How does our taking up role compare with the role for CIMO, the currency, and transactions that are going on within Paris? And if those countries are able to take up with us, because they think that the chief issue was only to have the weapons, how far are we in Paris? My second question here is as this figure is in place, maybe in this case we have about 350 to 400 staff when it's fully implemented. How far are we within those phases, if there are three or four phases? At what stage are we at now? And my third question is as we in this case that we have some of the chief perspectives from other law enforcement bodies, and at the same time you want to protect the integrity of the confidentiality of information that comes from other bodies of the force. Once that segment or the segment of staff from other institutions or other law enforcement bodies complicate the issue of sufficient potentiality within the pricing itself.
We've taken three hands.
take from the technical blogger and then after this page, and then we'll just go to the after the scoring, and then we'll take the next.
Thank you, sir. I just want to find out from the FIC whether they will get any feedback from the American administration on the benefits of having this system. Secondly, the challenges that they face in terms of ensuring that there's compliance. And I just read somewhere, I can't remember, there was an article that said KPMG, I think, did an international comparison. Issues of compliance. Can you mention that on that aspect? The last one is related to the administration. I just want to find out whether you have any memorandum of understanding that you have signed, memorandum of understanding that you have signed in the region.
Can we then take responses to the question or then we'll see the next question?
Sure, let's do that. There are a number of different questions. I'd like to refer them to members of the team. There's the issue of compliance, the cost of compliance, the benefits thereof, the flow through from that from both members working against them. There's also then the regulatory component thereof, talking about risk-based and related issues, and how does one deal with the accusations of onerousness, burden, regulatory burden, and so on. And I'm going to ask a combination of Mr. Smith and Mr. Milan to deal with some of those issues. I'm pleased that Honourable Member Molotov raised the issue of the KPMG report, because in some respects, that KPMG delivered a report last week which deals with the results of the international survey in relation to exactly these issues. And what is interesting, I'm going to ask the others to provide a feedback on that. But they find quite almost contradictory responses from banks themselves, having initially dug in their heels, complained about the onerousness, and now beginning to talk about benefits, and in fact, even a further possible areas of regulation to assist them in their work. So we need to talk about that. And then around the phase of integrity and so on, and if I may just quickly touch on those aspects initially. We always envisaged we would take up to 5 years to get the basis, the first element of the FIC, the center, as well as the sort of compliance element in place. We're moving towards this year, coming year, will be the fifth year. We need to have a core staff of 135, that was our initial estimate, in place to fulfill all the different functions, and to then have a spread of compliance implementation and compliance monitoring. We felt an initial plan that would give us the first plateau, so to speak, in terms of the overall rollout. We envisaged then that it would take another 3 years or so to get up to what we considered to be a sort of fully functioning FIC. And we're working towards that, and the appropriate funding, the appropriate skilling, and the appropriate relationship to be able to do that. So we're very much on track. And I think it's also important that as we move ahead, we've been constantly referring to colleagues, other countries, as to the progress that they've made, how they have phased in or approached implementation issues, and how setting up a criteria to benchmark our progress. It's clear we're very much in line with what other countries had done and are doing. It's pretty much one-on-one relationship in with regard to that. It's clear that we are at the very front of the curve in relation to the IT and the use of electronic systems to deal with a lot of the reporting and a lot of the analysis stuff and so on. And so that is very, very heartening.
Chair, we're also clearly on a par with the reporting size, the number of suspicious transactions received, the number of referrals that get made through to law enforcement. That is the figure that is pretty much out there for the equivalent organization. Not much more, not much less. Where we do anticipate a much larger number of reports coming through would be once the IT system is in place, and that starts happening automatically, obviously. But these are suspicious transactions. In other words, individuals within an account or institution have picked up something, they've applied their minds, they've looked at their internal rules and procedures, they see something which they think is out of the ordinary, have considered it, have sent it through for a sign or before then sending it through. By the time it comes through to us, majority of those, we believe, have gone through a process of consideration. We will then pick up on it and take it another step or two further before referring it. Many of us get put on the database and it stays there for some future processing. I must emphasize that at all times under the present regime, those are suspicious. They remain suspicious. It's not truth. It's not evidence. It's not conclusive by any means. Only once the investigation has taken place, and only once there's been decision on the side of the investigators, this might well lead to a case, can the rest of the process take off. It's out of our hands completely. So we need to stress that point. The point I also want to make is that in relation to an SDR, one SDR very seldom means one referral. Very seldom. Rather, what we are seeing increasingly is that a number of referrals would then be brought together and then lead into a sense of, it's clearly suspicious, or it's clearly more than simply suspicious activity. There's something happening beneath this that needs to then be looked at, analyzed further, and then referred to investigating. So that equivalent to one SDR should equal one referral doesn't work by any means. And certainly we there with our counterparts anywhere in the world in relation to that. If I could refer to Advocate Smith to deal with some of the regulatory issues that flow from the honourable members Wood and Gibson's queries around the regulatory side, the earnestness of it, some of the feedback from SMG, for example, recently, and the international benchmarking requirements, references made to developing ID verification approach. Why did we do that? What are the benefits of that? In relation to other countries, what's the meaning of that? We deal with that. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Chief. I think you can one question on the you can use the word over compliance. And I think a specific example specifically was part of the process where the financial institutions, especially banks, went through a very focused process of clearing out existing clients that were part of their business structure and their client base at the time or before this legislation came into effect. And therefore they had to play a catch-up role themselves to get an understanding and get it based on this information in respect to those clients. And it's in that process where we found that the institutions are taking a very cautious approach to how they go about their cost. And we're not necessarily looking internally at business processes that would facilitate an easier way of obtaining that information from clients or making better use of internal systems, but rather just ask the client up front for that information, and if they need to ask the client two or three or four or five clients within that system. To be cautious enough and insistent enough that they just get that information. I think that has been a learning process for us. And as Uncle Richard pointed out, we are taking the lessons and the feedback that we're getting from the seriously. Part of the review process that we shall talk about and looking at the legislation that we have currently is precisely for this purpose and see how the legislation can be accommodated to find more intelligent ways of implementing and achieving this. The legislative approach is very much one of our issues that we've researched and looked at. It is very much the forefront of development internationally. understanding science, business and sense, the nature of the science activities, and focusing much more on the ongoing relationship with the client rather than the upfront identification of the client, which is one thing that is an ongoing process. Finding ways for institutions to exploit institutions in relation to how they comply with those organizations, in relation to different types of clients and different types of business lines and products that they offer to clients. So there is a large amount of work that we will be undertaking in the next foreseeable future around these questions, especially in relation to how the relationship between financial institutions and clients can be used more intelligently to obtain same amount of information but allocating resources to these things differently. I think this exercise is the experience of the client side, but it's really end of the implementation of our institutions that they have affected, and I think it's seen by clients as a point of information fundamentally. The issue there is that this has become very much part and parcel of the sense we're doing business internationally, and this isn't going away quite properly. Clients, the financial institutions will have to understand, know their clients, they will have to understand their clients' business. They can, this can vary in certain degrees to respect a certain type of clients or categories of business, but it isn't going away. It's going to be there, and it will be an ongoing feature of business in either financial sector. And if we look at international developers, the revised international standards that we're actually falling behind now, the revision that took place more or less at the same time as our legislation became operational. In a number of respects, the bar has actually been raised for institutions to find out more about their clients rather than less, and to know more about who's behind the client, who's the beneficial owner, who controls the client, especially in the corporate sector. So I think there's, in some instances, there was actually more interrogation required from institutions to understand what the client is that they're dealing with, and how they monitor the client process on an ongoing basis. I think this ties in with what we've seen in terms of the international surveys, for instance, the KPMG surveys that we've just done across the board, internationally, across the globe, the speed on implementation of systems to comply with these measures exceeded what these regions had expected 4 years ago. Take on this, which is probably in relation to the revision of the international standards that are being implemented across the board by countries in all the financial sector around the globe. What has been significant in the study is in the Africa and Middle East region, the spend has actually been significantly more than in other extent in terms of percentages compared to other countries or other parts of the financial sector. I think that is indicative of the fact that this part of the globe, the African and Middle Eastern sector, is doing a lot of work, spending a lot of money and resources on reaching the same level of implementation and expectation as applied in Western Europe and North America. The reason for that is that the financial institutions in these sectors need to compete with financial institutions on an equal basis, which brings us back to the issue of risk-based and monitoring. When institutions from North America and Western Europe does business with institutions in Africa or Middle East or even the Far East, they implement their own risk-based risk and assessments of those institutions and what level of trust there is within the systems in those institutions and our enemies and a close view of customers and business. And depending on the trust and the integrity of the system in our part of the world, for instance, it will either be more difficult or easier for our institutions to pass on the business and have a close view of the institutions based in London and New York. So there is an inevitability about the implementation of these standards and according to international practice. We do not believe really to say that our implementation or our requirements have exceeded the international requirements and international standards. And as I said, if we compare what we have at the moment in our legislation with what the current standard requires, we do see a lot of areas where we really need to improve and adjust what we have to catch up with it. some of the factors that institutions have taken into account to assess that it's in relation to certain science are would be based on the sort of feedback that they would get from institutions like Kentucky and John Boston. And it also depends on the outcomes of things like mutual evaluation that are carried out by the FNDF or financial sector assessments that are carried out by the IMF sector. And the sort of information about the system that is available publicly. And all of those would be taken into account on the issue. It's a developing science to understand exactly how it is that the approach would be applied and what the implications thereof would be. I think by no means should it be assumed that applying a risk-based approach would mean less cost to institutions or generally a less applicable factor for clients. It may mean less applicable factor for some clients, but it may mean more applicable factor for other clients. And the jury is still out in exactly how that would be implemented. It's very much at the forefront of development in other cost reports as well. I think that I would end up on this area to say that in particularly in South Africa's case, I expect that the experience and the perception of science is likely to change in the future. I think that the initial experience of science is a very specific exercise that institutions have gone through, that exercise has been gone through now, that has reached in process, and from the institutions will be focusing on monitoring the science information that they have and on carrying out in relation to new science coming on at the outset. They're also trying to guide institutions to provide focus on obtaining that information on a holistic basis in relation to clients, so that for our purposes, an institution has an overview of the business line of the contact with the institution and does not lead to saying information two or three times from the it is much better for our purposes that the client and the institution can monitor the client's activity holistically and compare the client's activity on bond account to its activity on the check account. And it must be easy to see the so we expect that the ample factor and the pain in the process to decrease, to become relatively less in the future. It will always be there. Can't avoid that to go through the process to some extent. And as part of the ongoing way that this will be done in the financial sector.
Chair, there are a couple of unanswered aspects here. The one would be, has a cost-benefit analysis been done? Simple answer is no. However, having said that, we recently appointed a researcher to begin a process to assist us in understanding what those cost-benefit results would be, to try and determine what criteria would be used to assess that, so that we could, over the next few years, begin to understand better the effectiveness or otherwise of the legislation and of our work. We want to increasingly understand what are the outcomes of this entire process. And in the process of that, what either blockages we need to deal with or efficiencies need to be enhanced and increased in from. So I can't give you that answer at this point in time, other than to say that we are very aware that this is an area that we want to be working on. That then relates back to the issue of conditions at the end of the day. And you'll recall that when the Minister was in this committee a few months ago, beginning of June, he made reference to it. I think that we need to understand that yes, there's an earnestness, a sense of compliance requirements on the side of the reporting institutions. What is the outcome at the end of the prosecution or the end of that value chain? Again, I can't tell you how many convictions there have been, and I can't tell you how many investigations are ongoing as a direct result of FIC referrals or as a result of the compliance that's been put into effect. I simply don't know. And again, that is something which is of concern to us and to the minister. It's an issue which we're in discussion with the law enforcement authority, the National Prosecuting Authority, to be able to get a better handle on the results of our work, but more generally. I need to also make a point that in terms of poker, that piece of statute is there for any investigator to be able to use and to utilize. We're not responsible for ensuring that all potential money laundering transgressions become a conviction necessarily. Obviously, we would welcome them in a position to be able to influence the outcome of that. At this point in time, we can't. And I think it's something that does concern me, because in our mutual evaluation next year, we will be required to be able to provide those set statistics. I know from my interactions with the various law enforcement authorities at this point in time that it's very clear that there are more and more investigations taking place which involve financial components and involve information from the FIC and look at poker and so on. You don't need to read the media, for example, to know that that's beginning to take place the last 6 months. I'm also aware of a couple of instances now, and I can't give you the details, I'm not allowed to give you the details, where successful money laundering convictions have been made, where we've worked the entire value chain. And I need to say that because it grows out of our concern that there is this money spent, and we need to see the benefits of that. And if it's not going to happen automatically, then in a sense we need to try to intervene to ensure that all elements of the chain are being adhered to and brought together and so on. There's a recent case where we received reports, we did the analysis, we took it to law enforcement for investigation, we assisted the investigation, we assisted in preparing the case and the prosecution, backed it up from beginning to end, and secured. We didn't, but the prosecutor secured the successful prosecution. And I think, hopefully out of all of that, we understand better the entire system. We are better able to assist and back up and support the different agencies involved in that process, and hopefully also become something of a model for future such work. But that's very much for the future, for the forthcoming year and so on. But it does mean then that the FIC as an institution cannot be simply a passive recipient of reports and then feeding it through, that we have to more actively engage with our counterparts on the law enforcement side to assist them to utilize the new tools that are available in the form of the analyzed product as well as the legislation that's there for them.
One outstanding component was a question about a relationship in the region and MOU signed in the region. Could I ask Mr. Zika to comment on that, please?
Thank you, Chair. In terms of the MOUs, I'd like to paraphrase my response by saying that when you talk about the region, we're talking about either Africa in general or the Eastern and Southern Africa anti-money laundering and region which we belong to. And members have to understand that we can only sign MOUs with governments that have established the financial intelligence unit or are in the process of establishing the financial intelligence unit. And having said that, within ASAMLEC itself, we have signed an MOU with Zimbabwe and Mauritius. We are in the process of signing MOUs with Seychelles and Namibia and Mozambique, which we are currently assisting now in setting up their financial intelligence unit. We are also in the process of signing an MOU with Nigeria to continue the financial intelligence unit, and we've been many discussions with them. I think that answers.
I have four more hands, but I want to suggest that we take a 10-minute break, have some coffee, and then come back to the session. And then I have Mr. Dupere, Mr. Marais, and Mr. Babaji, and Mr. Abir. And then we'll take them. I think